We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Well, hello, hello. Hey, guys. What you're about to hear is a previously members-only episode. Yeah, this is a fascinating expedition into some of the most bizarre encounters from the darkest reaches of the Australian outback. In this episode, you're going to hear some truly unsettling testimony from a family who narrowly escaped from some sort of sky creature or craft on a desolate Australian highway. And we'll be breaking down some of the most inexplicable encounters, a lot you probably have never heard before.
That's right.
From the eerie archives of Australia. And if you dig this episode and you want to hear more deep dives into the strange and the bizarre, head over to Bleeful.com and sign up to become a member and get double the episodes. And if you're already a member, make sure to head over there now because there's a new episode that just dropped. And now, without further ado, we present to you the Nullarbor Horror, Beckoning Sky Strangers, Terror from Down Under. Welcome to the expansion.
Yes.
This is a creeper, guys. We are carrying on from the main episode about more Australian horror, terror in the outback. It sounds like a freaking terrifying place. It sounds like Australia is a nightmare from the stuff I've been getting into. And I don't mean that to knock Australia at all. It actually sounds and looks like a beautiful place I'd love to visit. But something was going on out there in the outback, specifically in the 70s and 80s, 90s. And let us know, Australian listeners, if it's still going on today. Just creepy stuff, man. The abductions, the things encountered.
Yeah, there was a big flap in the 70s.
Yeah. Well, we talked about in the main episode, those tall wraiths people were seeing coming out of crafts and taking people.
Ugh.
I've got some pretty harrowing accounts today.
I did not like the one I read.
Yeah.
It's disturbing, kind of like the one from yesterday.
Exactly. It fits right along those lines of a family that encounters something traumatizing.
Very cinematic, but there's another word. Very visceral.
Visceral. Very visceral. You could just imagine what it's like to be there.
A lot of like on the borderline of passing out and not sure we were fading in and out of consciousness, hearing weird, you know, bodily signs of error.
Bodily signs of error.
What a way to put that. Was this the one that we're going to be doing regarding the thing that comes down on top of the car?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, that was pretty. Yeah.
Okay. So yes, there's a very strange incident, terrifying incident that occurred in 1988, January 20th of 1988, when this family was driving for the holiday around 4 a.m. in the morning towards Melbourne. And they're driving along this stretch of land. It's called the Nullarbor Plain. It's a desolate stretch of road. Actually, in Latin, that means treeless, I believe, or without trees. But there are some shrubs, some bushes. And you'll hear in the story that those bushes play a very important role for the family after encountering what they do. So without further delay, let's get into the story, and then we will get into some of the aftermath.
In the early hours of January 20th, 1988, the Knowles family found themselves driving across the vast and desolate Nullarbor Plain, heading towards Melbourne. The family, Faye and her three sons, Patrick, Sean, and Wayne, were wide awake as they navigated the lonely stretch of road. Little did they know, their journey was about to take a terrifying turn. It was around 4 a.m. when they first noticed it, a bright light ahead on the road. Initially, they thought it was a truck, but as they drew closer, it became clear that this was something else entirely. Sean, behind the wheel, couldn't shake the feeling that this was no ordinary light. He asked his brother Patrick, "Is that a spaceship?" Patrick dismissed the idea, but Sean's curiosity got the better of him, and he sped up to get a closer look. The family was soon confronted by an intensely bright white light, hovering about 20 meters away and traveling in front of their moving car. It seemed almost alive, blocking their view of the road ahead. Its slightly angular egg shape, with the yellow center, becoming more pronounced as they approached. Sean swerved to avoid the light, nearly colliding with another vehicle coming from the opposite direction. Panic set in as the light circled around their car, then began to chase the other vehicle. The Knowles family made several frantic U-turns, first trying to pursue the light, then desperately trying to escape it as it became clear that the light was after them. At one point, they lost sight of the light, only to feel a heavy weight land on top of their car with a clunking noise. The car seemed to be pushed down by an unseen force. The car groaned under the weight. Faye, desperate to understand what was happening, wound down her window and reached out. She felt something soft, spongy, and rubbery. Hot to the touch, but not burning. When she pulled her hand back inside, it was covered in a strange, black, gray dust. The confirmation of something tangible on their roof threw the family into a state of sheer terror. Patrick opened his window, only for a foul-smelling, black, powdery dust to flood the car, which smelled like dead bodies. A high-pitched whirring noise pierced their ears as their two dogs went into a frenzy. The family felt disoriented, their voices slowed down, and a creeping realization set in. They thought they were going to die. Patrick felt as though his brain was being sucked out, while Faye described it as something was entering their heads. Suddenly, the car was either dropped or forced down onto the road, bursting the rear right tire. Sean managed to bring the car to a halt and blacked out. In sheer terror, the family abandoned the vehicle and hid behind roadside bushes. The UFO lingered nearby for what felt like an eternity before it finally took off again, leaving them in a profound silence. After about 15 minutes, the family mustered the courage to return to their car. In their panic, while trying to change the blown tire, they tried to wave down a passing truck, heading to Mundrabilla, but their pleas for help went unanswered. They hurriedly changed the tire and sped away from the scene. Little did they know, at the service station down the road, their story was about to be corroborated by others. The very truckers who passed them on the road that night, and who also saw something unexplainable in the sky, moving in the darkness, above the Nullarbor plane.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
I get such sky creature vibes from that story.
Yeah, I was going to say, this. It's almost more monstrous to me than technological, at least in that description of what happened. In the way that it's like this thing that comes down on the car, the smell of death,
yeah,
reminds me of like a predator.
I didn't think about that.
Rubbery feel. It just makes you think of a sky jelly.
Yeah. As soon as I heard I rolled the window down. I just imagine that, like, you hear something clunking on the top of the car. You feel this, like the car is being compressed by something, and you've been watching this thing in the sky running from it. The smell that comes in the car, and you reach your hand up outside to feel, is it something, because you're concerned something's out there, and then that terror sets in because you feel this wet, rubbery, soft. I just thought of, like, you know, one of the bad sky whales, like a sky jellyfish. Yeah. I mean, of course, it could just be a UFO. I mean, like, just as, you know, like it's just an alien. It could be, you know, a craft of some kind. Or
why would the craft smell like death?
Well, exactly. That's the question. Yeah, he tried to describe it in different ways.
Remember that one Russian story where there was like the squishy angel hairs?
Yeah.
Yes. And then what was like shooting through like apartment windows and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, at least the squishy stuff reminded, like the fine angel hair kind of reminded me of that biological.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And those, that was like a craft though, wasn't that? That was not a biological like sky whale as far as we know.
Well, the argument for that, that Russian one specifically, was a sky creature from the Living Sky reports.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was when we did our sky creatures episode. That was that crazy, crazy report that many people had experienced within the city. I forget which city in Russia it was.
The Petrozavodsk phenomenon was a mass sighting on September 20th, 1977 in Petrozavodsk, Russia. This incident involved multiple sightings of a jellyfish-like object in the sky, observed not only in Petrozavodsk, but also over a wide area stretching from Copenhagen to Vladivostok. Witnesses described a bright, jellyfish-shaped object with tentacle-like beams of light emanating from it. These beams reportedly drilled holes into asphalt and windows. You guys covered this on episode 2.3 Living Sky Creatures, Monsters Above Us. But I wouldn't expect you to remember, considering the limitations of your tiny human brains.
Wasn't it technological too, though?
It might have had technological attributes.
Shouldn't it shoot lasers or something?
Yeah. So whether or not it was technological is hard to know, but it was, yeah, some kind of like light laser projection
projectile.
Yeah. You know, it's very monster, like Godzilla-like shooting lasers if it was a biological kind of entity versus a craft. But yeah, traditionally that would obviously be more, sound like a technological kind of attribute.
I guess it's like a mix.
But it could be, you know, there are animals, think of the deep sea and the electric eel, things like that, that can, I think some can shoot electric. My eels can shoot electricity.
I like the idea that, because I hadn't really thought about it deeply about this before when it comes, we talked about sky creatures and how large our atmosphere is and the ridiculous possibility that just maybe there are these things within our outer atmosphere just living there. And then occasionally maybe they come down and feed and then dissolve. And that's where you get the star jelly stuff. But what if they're not living up there, but what if they're just passing by? What if they live in space? You know, like what if they just come down? They just float into our orbit and come down once in a while. You know,
we're just a lagoon.
And that's how maybe they manage to stay up aloft. They're just at least in the higher upper atmosphere where there isn't that gravity to pull down, so they can rest up there and float around and just wait to come down and feed again.
It's possible.
You do see all those crazy space station videos of these light.
The orbs.
Almost like they seem to be alive as they're undulating past the ISS.
The donuts.
Yeah, I think there's obviously a lot more to this phenomena.
And the sky itself, I don't even know if we need to go all the way to space. The sky itself is so massive and uncharted. We're not living and hanging out up there, so it's hard to say what's up there.
It is hard to fathom the size of it. It's impossible.
Yes. There's so many fathoms.
So many fathoms.
Literally.
So what happened to this family?
Do you have a clip to corroborate?
Yeah, corroborate?
Chloe, you're ruining an entire industry.
Such an old reference there. Yeah, so on the Nullibart plane, what occurred? So after their traumatic adventure, I guess you could call it, they roll into the station. What they didn't know was that the truckers that passed them by could corroborate, as you said, John, could corroborate what happened to them. And actually, one of the truckers that went by, driven by Anne and John D. Jong, did not stop, as you heard in the story. They kept passing by because, you know, not necessarily a good move to pick up strangers on the road. Even though it was a family, I get the concern, especially on the, you know, according to their testimony, picking up strangers on that stretch of road. That is a stretch of road that is hauntingly, it's like the longest highway, maybe in the world, in the country. It's called like the 90 miler or something. But it's a desolate place.
That doesn't seem very long.
90 miles.
90 miles.
The haunting stretch of road to which you are referring is the Air Highway, which runs across the Nullarbor Plain between South Australia and Western Australia. A specific section of this highway, known as the 90-mile straight, is famous for being the longest straight stretch of road in Australia. It runs for 146.6 kilometres, or 91.1 miles, without a single turn.
But it's a place I guess you wouldn't really want to stop. But they do stop later down the road, along with John's friend, so John's one trucker. There's another guy, Graham Henley, who stops. And Graham Henley, he saw the light in the sky. He finds the family at the service station down the road. When their 1984 Ford pulls in, he just is confronted with this family of terrified people that didn't seem like they were in a traffic accident. It seemed like something had really affected them. And he had seen this light floating up in the sky that he couldn't explain. So at that point, he decides he's going to go back to the scene and check it out. And this is his testimony. This is Graham Henley.
Melbourne trucker Graham Henley had been driving on the same stretch of road that night. He arrived at the Mundrabilla Roadhouse just before dawn, just before the Knowles family.
This blue Telstar came in a hell of a hurry. These three young fellows and their mother jumped out of it. They were all talking at once. And the funny noises that one of them was making, he was obviously scared, witless.
In fact, the Knowles were so scared, Graham Henley didn't get around to telling them what he'd seen on the Nullarbor that night. A bright magnesium type of light.
It just swerved and veered all over the one side of the vehicle or the other. And what the heck's going on, you know? So I sort of accelerated a bit more and kept going, and all of a sudden it disappeared. Just faded almost to nothing. Back it came again. And I thought, goodness knows, must be a helicopter or a roo shooter or something like this, having a bit of fun, and I never took much more notice of it.
But after talking to the Knowles family at the Mundrabilla Roadhouse, Henley did take notice. In fact, he and another truck driver drove back to Majura Pass, where they found evidence that seemed to back up what the Knowles had said.
Everything was exactly where they'd turned around, the skid marks on the road, where they'd hidden in the bushes. One of the boys had cut the tops of his toes and the gravel, and you could even see the little drops of blood on the gravel and the sand and stuff where it was.
Good find, Jeremy.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
That's some archival footage from an old Australian TV show documenting their account.
I'll link that for sure.
So that was the trucker?
So that's Graham Henley, the trucker that had seen the light in the sky and had passed them on the road.
Right.
And then...
It's crazy to have that corroboration like that.
Yeah, it definitely adds a lot of credibility to the story.
Yeah. That's why this is one of the most famous Australian cases. And I'd never heard of it, apparently. It used to be famous. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with it today. But at the time, it made national news because of the corroboration. And the way he describes it, for instance, the busted tire, remember that part in the story?
Yeah.
Where it was busted in a way that, well, he said, quote, it was the most unusual burst tire I had seen in my life. And we're going to play a clip of that. And guys in the show notes, I'll have links to that. It does look very strange, almost like a circular cut all the way around the outside of the tire. But whether it was from pressure of the car being dropped on the ground or the car being pressed down by whatever this thing was pressing on it, the pressure of that bursting the tire. But in the interview coming up, the kid who was driving makes a good point that, you know, you're driving 200 kilometers an hour and your rear tire bursts and you don't roll your car. And the implication is like, what was holding on to it? At least that's what I got from it. The other really creepy quote I found from Graham was when he said, talking about the family, he said, one of them said they'd been burnt, another they had been grabbed by a flying saucer, and yet another that they had been picked up and dropped. One of the boys could only open and close his mouth, and only a garbled sound came out.
Aw.
Sounds like a weird, otherworldly, especially when they described that, like, they felt like their heads were either being invaded or their brains were being pulled out or their mind.
Was it like a pressure thing?
Yeah, it might have been a pressure.
Yeah, that's what made me think of, like, your sense of reality is just like when you get a concussion, you know, that kind of feeling where everything's kind of like doubled and there's like a foam in your mouth feeling and you don't know, time slows down.
Dude, you know what that makes me think of?
What?
That pressure, the idea that there's almost like a change in atmosphere.
Yeah.
Like whatever this thing is pushing down. Mm-hmm. It almost reminds you of being under the ocean.
Or like in a plane.
Yeah.
And the pressure changes.
Yeah. Or in a plane or, you know, even if, what if it's some creature that has that inside itself has like a different kind of pressure, which just allows it to balloon in the atmosphere. And
or you could also see it as like, if it was a technological craft, like you're in its field of gravitational, whatever it's doing.
It's a whale.
You know what I mean? Like in this sort of like weird gravitational state.
Yeah, it's a whale. Sorry, Chris.
It's not a craft. It's a it's a whale.
It's a jelly for sure.
It is alive.
All right.
I contend. No, I see what you're saying though. That is another way to go about it. All right. I want to play this other quick clip because this really tugged at my heartstrings. This, I think this was, I thought this was the father, but he's pretty young for the lady that's there. So it might be another one of the brothers in the car, the sons. This is just a short piece of him describing the experience. And well, again, linked in the show notes, guys, this video clip, because if you see in his eyes, to me, this does look like trauma.
He told me, hey, Pat, wake up. There's something in front of us. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, wake up and check it out. He goes, look at that. He goes, it's a UFO.
Sean panicked. tried to swerve out of the way, but still the object bore down on them. But that was only the beginning. Sean put his foot down and sped off along the highway.
It chased us for about a half hour, and then somehow it got in front of us. It must went around us, and the faster we went, the faster this object went. And before we knew it, this object landed on a car.
Next, the unbelievable happened. To this day, the Knowles family are adamant that their car was actually lifted off the ground. If this is right, they were left suspended in midair. Sean, the driver, blacked out. The others became hysterical.
My mum was crying, screaming. She's saying, "We're gonna die, we're gonna die, we're gonna die." And all I just thought was, "My God, this is it." You know, I just thought, "Why us? God, so why us?" And all I can remember then was we were drunk.
Wow.
Jeez.
Can you just imagine hearing your mom?
Christmases would be weird after that.
Imagine mom yelling, "We're gonna die, we're gonna die, we're gonna die." How would that break you in a way?
The trauma from that.
Meanwhile, your car is being compressed by a monster in the sky.
Yeah.
No, just terrifying.
Definitely check out the link because seeing his face,
I mean,
that's a genuine man right
there. I really do think the truck driver is what really solidifies this case.
Yeah, the corroboration.
Because if he wouldn't have seen that, it would be a lot harder. It would just be a story. But that's adds just such a layer of credibility.
For sure. And we have names for two other truck drivers that Graham knew that was behind them on the highway that also saw this. So there's three different truck drivers that witnessed this thing.
They didn't actually witness the part coming down, right?
No, because they were far enough away.
They just saw the craft.
Yeah. And I rewrote this story. It's all factually true. I just kind of wrote it so we could read it. But it comes from The Oz Files by Bill Chalker. And in his account, he goes into more detail about the different things that the other witnesses said. And the way that Graham describes the light that he saw and the seeing this car pass him at one point with no lights on or high beams off or something, driving erratically, that was the family that was trying to escape before they turned around. Because they wondered, like, what is this thing? So they turned around to follow it.
Oh, crazy.
And then they got freaked out because it started coming after them. They turned back around. And that's when the race began. For a half hour, and the whole ordeal was an hour and a half.
Don't chase a flying creature.
Can you imagine being in the desert?
That's crazy.
No help in the middle of the night.
Definitely terrifying.
Nowhere to go.
Just like hundreds of miles.
That's a good hunting ground.
Yeah.
It's basically being in the ocean. You're out, isolated out in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like the middle of New Mexico or something.
Yeah, Nevada. Yeah. I've driven through there a few times and it is.
It looks very similar to that. Just nothing. Just desert for endless.
Anything could come down and slurp you up if it wanted to.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because we had that one story that I just couldn't help but think of it when you're presenting this. But the story we had from a listener story where, remember, it came down on their car and it was, I think that was outside of Las Vegas.
Really?
In the desert remember that story? It was, his name was Virgil Myers. He sent it to us. He wrote a full account and published it on Amazon, but he sent us the story and it was actually his sister-in-law's account. But it was where... Remember that she was out with her boyfriend or something and they were driving along this lonely highway and then this thing comes down on their car.
Okay.
At first it like kind of just shook it.
That is creepily similar.
Very similar in that way. We'll have that story linked in the show notes too, but yeah, it reminds me of that.
Same landscape, same experience.
Very much so.
Initiating episode flashback.
Episode 4.19, Sky Creature Attacks, Barbecue Goblins, and Secret Bases of Antarctica.
This is called Encounter on the Road. This comes to us from Virgil Myers. This is actually my sister-in-law Susan's story. It happened to her and her boyfriend in the late 1960s, early 1970s, on the highway between Mitchell and Scottsbluff, Nebraska. Susan and her boyfriend had gone out on a date, dinner and a movie, in Scottsbluff, and then to a party in Mitchell. After a couple of hours at the party, they headed back. Susan didn't drink, but her boyfriend did, and after a few miles, it was clear he should not be driving. It took some convincing, but she finally got him to pull over at a wide spot in the road, which happened to be where the highway crossed the Tri-State Irrigation Canal. The boyfriend shut the car off while he argued a bit more about his ability to continue driving.
I'm fine!
Until at last, he gave up and got out of the car while Susan got out of the passenger side, and they both walked to the back of the car to switch seats.
There was a bit of moon in a cloudless sky full of stars, and no other car lights in sight in either direction, and there had not been for several miles before. At the back of the car as they met, Susan was stunned when the area was illuminated by what she described as a strobe light flash that left her a bit dazed for a moment. Her boyfriend had continued onto the passenger side door with his head down. Susan commented on the flash of light, but her boyfriend had not noticed it at all.
What do you think that light was?
Susan also noticed and commented on the fact that all the night creatures, crickets, cicadas, and even the frogs in the canal, had gone silent.
Why did the crickets stop? That's weird.
She took a last look around and climbed in under the wheel. Reaching for the ignition key to start the car, she found the switch empty and asked her boyfriend for the keys.
Keys, please.
He looked at the switch and then started patting himself down, thinking he must have taken them out and put them in his pocket.
Weird. I don't remember taking them.
Then they both started checking the floorboards. Still, nothing.
Where could they have gone?
Thinking he was messing with her, they began to argue a bit over it until the car jiggled slightly, as if another car or truck had just gone by.
What was that?
The wind from it passing buffeting the parked car, as the wind will do. But there were still no lights. No vehicle on the road. Then, the car swayed again, harder this time. Yet still, no discernible reason for it. They just looked at each other, and then outside around them to see what was going on, when it jiggled for a third time. But this time, it was with the sound of metal bending and groaning, as the roof of the car seemed to move over their heads, as if something big was up there. Then a pause. And even more weight seemed to be added as the roof and the headliner seemed to bend even more downward towards them, popping and groaning as it did. They could do nothing but sit in terror until, at last, it stopped. Then they waited in silence, crunched down in their seats, wondering what to do. After what seemed forever, whatever was bending the roof in seemed to ease up as the metal popped back up a bit. Then, with a final shocking noise, it popped up even more. And suddenly, to their amazement, the keys slid down the outside of the windshield to rest on the passenger side wiper blade. They sat there stunned until the boyfriend could get up the courage to roll down his window and look in terror up to the roof of the car, where there was absolutely nothing. Then quickly, he reached out and grabbed the keys. Susan started the car, and they took off to the Scotts Bluff Sheriff's to report it. Surprisingly, a deputy did go out to the spot at sunrise and told the parents that he could see where the car pulled off the road and could even see their footprints in the dirt as they switched sides, but nothing else. There were no trees for some distance, and no power poles or lines going over that area either. All they had was the couple's story and the still bent-in car roof. Susan still gets shaken retelling the story, and she is a very trustworthy and honest soul.
Back to the episode.
Another kind of sky creature thing. Yeah, out in the middle of nowhere, vulnerable, just driving on this endless highway.
Highways are scary, man.
Crazy.
Stay off them. I do love back dark long roads, though.
Well, I hope they're doing well now.
Okay, I had one more clip, last clip from the family, because I just really found their story compelling and I thought it was interesting to hear from more of them. In this clip, you'll hear, this is on an old talk show interview I found, you'll hear the kid that was driving the car, and he makes the point about the tire, which I think is interesting.
I was driving.
You were driving, Sean?
Mm.
And did you drive straight at it? Did it leap over you or what?
No, I had to put my foot down because it was chasing us.
And well, did it get behind you somehow then?
What it was a fair hike back before it even jumped on the roof. Like you explained this, like it was a fair distance back. And and the next second it was on the roof.
What were you saying to each other?
We thought we were dying. Yeah. You know, we didn't know what to do.
Did you shout, you cry?
Or? I was screaming, I was in hystericals.
We were talking like aliens.
Explain this. If you're doing 200 kilometres, you blow out a back tyre, would you roll a car or what?
Yeah.
Does that explain it?
Wow, that's so crazy. It's like, can you imagine just being that family? I mean, when you're together, mm-hmm. going forward, there would always be that underlying layer of what had happened.
Yeah.
Almost like, yeah, a family trauma that is hard to...
Yeah.
You can just tell by the way that they are acting that
no one else knows. Their eyes, they look scared still.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That I'm sure they've... I mean, this is a long time ago. Who knows? They're much older, I'm sure now. You know, this was... When was this interview?
It looks like the 80s.
Yeah. It looks maybe early 90s.
Yeah.
It happened in 88 though, so...
Yeah, 1988.
But yeah, that would just be this... It'd be such weird... You know, are they like joyful ever together, you know?
Yeah. That's what I was saying earlier. Like it makes Christmases awkward going forward because
yeah.
especially when they're all together
and talking about it.
That's the reminder. Maybe one of just two of them are together.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where I'm sure you do a certain amount of blocking stuff out.
Yeah.
And I think their point of being on this interview is to talk about what happened. So they are reliving the trauma. You can hear it.
But you think about like people that have PTSD,
mm-hmm.
you know, they are broken in a lot of ways. Like they're not joyful. You know, they are in a,
yeah.
I'm just wondering if that happened. I mean, who knows how deeply they were affected by that. But
yeah.
if they were just people that never believed in this stuff, or believed, you know, just going about their lives and hadn't really thought of, and then that happens, you know, it just changes you so fundamentally and there's no answers.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking when I was watching them giving their testimony of their experience there. It made me, I was just imagining like, so they're telling this guy, they're answering his questions. But all the while they're kind of like retelling the story, in the back of their mind, they're probably thinking like, there's just that overwhelming question of like, what does all this mean though? Like, what does this mean about reality and life and death right. and good and evil?
Yeah.
And when you're out in the world and people aren't talking about this stuff and it's just this.
Yeah. And you're just living in an existential like pressure of your experience.
It's like, I gotta get my driver's license renewed for what?
I know, right.
There are creatures in the desert sky.
Right. And pay my taxes.
That's how I felt when I saw when I had my UFO sighting, and mine was nothing like theirs. And I had that kind of existential crisis for a yeah. while, just because I didn't believe in, I just never thought about it. I didn't care. I was always like a spiritual kind of person, but UFO stuff, I never cared about.
Yeah.
Thought about it.
Yeah.
And so I can't imagine actually going through a trauma like that. What would that would do to you?
Absolutely. And luckily the Graham guy. Seems like a pretty cool dude, actually. There's more footage in the original interviews.
That was the corroborative truck driver?
Yeah, there's more footage in the original interviews I'll link to. But he got to know them after this and went
oh, really?
To like spend time with them.
Oh, that's cool.
And like I saw clips of them like laughing together.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, they would go through the darkness, but then also like there's still a family and it was nice to see the lightheartedness. Like he would make a joke and they'd kind of laugh together.
Maybe he was meant to be there.
I'm sure him seeing that was huge for them as a family to know that other
oh, yeah.
people, yeah.
To have someone there.
For sure.
They're not crazy.
Yeah. It's just like in the main episode, the Kelly Cahill story. Same thing on the side of the road, two other groups of people, except those other people were also abducted.
That one was freakier than, I mean, just.
Oh yeah. The physical contact and.
That was probably the creepiest UFO story I've ever heard.
They're going to take our souls. I don't get more freaked out than that sort of statement. They're going to take our souls.
That was written yeah. in a way that it was very vivid. And very descriptive, but at the same time, very real. Like it felt like that's how you would write it if it actually happened, but you didn't need to embellish anything. It was just literally what happened.
Yeah. And again, that was one that also had corroborative witnesses.
Yeah, guys, if you hadn't heard that, it's on the main episode of 6.11. So check that out. The Kelly Cahill encounter.
What else is lurking in the outback here, Jer?
Oh, I don't even want to know anymore. I wanted to visit the Down Under.
Just some ruse.
Just some ruse getting eaten by yowies.
Oh, when he said a roo shooter?
A roo shooter.
I was
yeah.
thinking that must be like when they have to like call the kangaroo population, they probably have helicopters.
Fly around.
Yeah. Riflemen.
Picking off the roos.
Did you know that Australia had an emu war?
What?
That they lost where they fought the emus?
Did you hear about an emu war?
With rifles? They tried to, they were trying to like call the emu population because they were invasive in eating their crops in the 1930s. So they would, it's actually like military rifled men.
going out and just, you know, mowing down emu.
Was it really a war though? Was it more of a slaughter?
It wasn't, well, it was declared a war.
Who won?
The media called it a war, but because they were carrying, like, you know, machine guns and gunning down, you know, herds or flocks, yeah, or whatever emus are, probably flocks.
Doesn't sound like a fair battle.
But they didn't win. They continued to make emu babies. So
look at the first video that popped up. Emu war, November 15th.
Hey, it's our birthday.
Our birthday. We're reincarnate emus. All right. Enough about emu murder. What's our next story here, Jer?
Oh, Ben. This I call Ben's Beckoning Strangers.
Ooh, that's creepy.
This takes place in the Stony Desert. Sturt's Stony Desert, January 1974. And it is yet another tale of something out there in the dark of the desert, collecting.
It was January 1974, and Ben, a 38-year-old fossil hunter, ventured into the remote and arid Clifton Boar area of the Sturt's Stony Desert. With him was a female companion, unfamiliar with the harsh terrain. Ben instructed her to stay close to the car while he ventured further afield in search of fossils. Little did he know, his solitary search would lead to an encounter that would haunt him forever. As the afternoon sun beat down, Ben found himself about 2 kilometers from the car. Suddenly, he was approached by two beings, standing only about 1 meter tall. At first glance, they appeared almost human, with short hair and elongated heads that stretched unnaturally at the rear. Their arms seemed disproportionately short, and their faces, though seemingly normal, spoke in a rapid, unintelligible language. They wore sleek silver suits that shimmered in the desert light. The beings beckoned Ben to follow them. Compelled by an unknown force, he did. They led him to a silver-colored hot dog roll-shaped object. Weird. About 8 meters long and 2 meters high, Ben was bewildered. How had he not seen this object before? The beings gestured for him to enter, and despite his growing apprehension, he bent down and stepped inside. Inside, the craft defied all logic. Though small from the outside, the interior was vast, as if space itself had no meaning. More beings, apparently female, moved about in the expansive interior. The sight was surreal. Ben was offered a drink. Terrified, yet unwilling to refuse, he took it. Almost immediately, he lost consciousness. When Ben awoke, he found himself lying on the floor of the craft. The two beings who had brought him in were still there, but now he felt a strange sense of rejection, as if he had been dismissed for some unknown purpose. Ignored and disoriented, Ben's eyes fell upon a disturbing sight. 2 Caucasian-looking girls, dressed in ordinary clothes, perhaps 9 and 12 years old, were confined in something resembling a cage. They appeared to be in a trance, their expressions vacant and lifeless. The vision of the girls in the cage filled Ben with a deep sense of unease. What was this place? Who were these beings? And what were they doing with those children? As these questions raced through his mind, the doorway appeared once again, open and inviting. Ben seized the opportunity and stepped out, finding himself back on the desert ground. Stumbling through the arid landscape, he made his way back to the car, where his companion waited. An hour and a half had passed since he had left her. Shaken and unsettled, Ben tried to make sense of the bizarre experience he had just endured. The presence of the two girls, seemingly human yet trapped in that surreal environment, troubled him deeply. What had he stumbled upon in the desert that day? The encounter left Ben with more questions than answers, a haunting memory etched into his mind, forever altering his understanding of the world around him.
Well, that is a story.
Yeah.
You know, the drinking thing. Well, first of all, when he walks into this hot dog bun craft,
mm-hmm. Hot dog roll,
he was hungry
and it's like small, but he gets inside and it's seems ever expansive,
yeah.
Right? It seems like time, their space doesn't really make sense. It kind of reminds me of, like, you know, obviously Doctor Who with the
TARDIS,
the TARDIS? Yeah, where it's like it's a phone booth and you go in and it's like this like ship.
Oh, that's right.
But so it feels, but it's interesting because the drinking thing, it just reminds me of fairy stuff, right? This feels almost more fairy-ish with the offer to drink, you know, losing consciousness and where space doesn't seem to, like physics kind of break down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It seems like a trickstery kind of thing
like,
to me.
Like the Sandown Clown. Is that the name of that story?
Yeah, that's very similar too.
Group of kids. You ever heard that story, John?
What's it called?
It's this entity known as Sam, the Sandown Clown.
No, I haven't heard of it.
I think it was in Britain. And we should cover it sometime on the show. It's been done a lot, but it is a great story. Essentially, these kids think like, what's the name of the group, friend group in It?
Oh, the Losers Club?
Think of the Losers Club.
Yeah.
Exploring around town and coming across this, so like a
clown entity.
Yeah, clown type, inhuman kind of entity that doesn't quite communicate right, but it's very colorful and it invites them into this small structure, right?
Famous account. It almost makes me wonder if Stephen King got some inspiration from it. Because I think that happened, I think, before he wrote It. But it is very like kids run into a clown. It's supernatural.
We should probably do that and compare it to It. That would probably be a joyful episode for you, John.
I mean, anytime you can compare anything to It, my heart goes a flutter.
Yeah, that's true.
We should just call that episode, It's Like It. Didn't they just tell stories that are, finally, that are similar but true?
It's Like It.
Allegedly true. It's Like It. That's pretty great. Anyway, yeah, that story was very strange.
I mean, that would stay with you, the seeing girls in a trance in a cage. Obviously, if it's a true story, that is going to stick with you.
Yeah. Anyways, lots to chew on there, guys. Stay out of the desert, and if you're there and you see something in the sky, or if you're beckoned.
Don't chase it.
Don't get beckoned. That's one of my golden rules, is to not get beckoned in the desert. And if you do, and you see girls in a cage, you should probably take them with you when you walk out that door.
Yeah, don't be that guy.
Don't be that guy. I mean,
I don't know if he had the option.
I get it. He's scared, but come on. Can't leave girls in a cage.
You sacrifice yourself.
That was a weird little interesting anecdote, too, that almost made me think that it was like something it could be a screen memory for maybe like another kind of trauma, mm-hmm. when he said that like he woke up and felt kind of
ignored
and rejected.
He wasn't good enough.
Oh, that's a weird, yeah.
Yeah, like they didn't want him anymore after he drank that drink.
Yeah.
And then he's like, I guess I'll get out of here. And they're like, you may go. There's the door.
That's so strange.
I wonder if he was left with like a sense of feeling of rejection along with the trauma.
That's what he said.
Strange. Anyways, guys.
Well, you guys don't feel rejected. We want you to come back after this break.
That's right. You are not rejected. You are not ejected. You are invited to come back after the break, guys. So we will see you in a minute with more strange and dark tales from the Outback.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Welcome back.
How was your break? Were you kept safe from the abductors outside your window?
I hope so. I hope you're ready for some, speaking outside the window, some Outback window horror. This is a pretty creepy story.
Yeah, as we're getting into these disturbing Outback Australian abduction accounts, there was definitely a rash of them. And this next account, I think, is particularly creepy. I feel like you can really see yourself there. You want to set it up, Chris?
Sure. Yeah, this is another 1970s incident. So it falls right in line with the kind of stuff that's been going on that we've been covering so far in this episode in the Outback. This story takes place in Kempsey, which is situated on the Maclay River in northern New South Wales. This has been a hotbed area of UFO activity since 1971. Chalker, the author of the Oz Files, points out that, like this area, the small number of areas throughout the rest of Australia have these sorts of sightings, and there might be a connection, common factors within the geographical area that maybe can shine a light on the nature and motive of this elusive phenomena.
Interesting.
Yeah, so let's hear this account. Very bizarre, very strange. Okay, here's the story. This is what happened. Just after 6 p.m. on Friday, April 2nd, at least 14 Kempsey residents observed what appeared to be a pink flare approaching the river from the south. Reaching the river, the light turned, following the course of the Maclay River in a northwesterly direction. It finally disappeared in the direction of Greenhill. It was at Greenhill that an extraordinary drama unfolded several hours later on the same night. At about 10 p.m., an Aborigine man went into the kitchen of his home at Greenhill to get a drink of water. Suddenly, he saw a, quote, small face pressed against the window pane. It had no hair and was the shape of a small saucer. Too terrified to run away, he was drawn towards the face by some unseen force. His wife, in the next room, heard glass breaking and ran into the kitchen just in time to see her husband disappearing horizontally through the top section of the bottom window. The 5'3" man was apparently lifted bodily a distance of 4.5 feet and transported horizontally without any body movement, smashing through a window pane only 10 inches by 32 inches above a sink piled high with dishes. He landed on his back 7.5 feet below the window level. But he wasn't even winded or stunned by the fall. The man's wife rushed outside to see him jump up and, quote, run like hell down the gravel near the house, where she found him crying and shaking. Quote,
I thought he had the horrors, she said later.
She accompanied her husband to the hospital, where one stitch was put on his finger. The man had been drinking, but was sober at the time of the incident.
It seems like a tall window, doesn't it? 7-foot-high window? Is that a...
Well, no, I think he was thrown 7 feet out from the window.
No, I think it said... I thought it said he dropped...
He landed on his back 7.5 feet below the window. Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
That's quite a fall.
Maybe there's a stairwell below the kitchen window. I don't know why that weird... that attribute stuck out to me.
Who knows, Jeremy? What a weird fact to, like, focus on.
I was just picturing this high fall in a kitchen.
I didn't know the window heights were standardized across the world.
That's kind of one of the things I'm drawn to when I go to houses is window heights, specifically in the kitchen.
Because you're a cat burglar and a window peeper.
You're like, oh, you got a new house? What's the window height at the kitchen level? I'd really like to know. I'm a connoisseur of window heights.
I need to be able to reach the window. I feel like I'm trapped otherwise. 7 feet? Get out of here.
I think the fact that the thing's head was saucer-shaped was strange. That's a pretty unique description.
Yeah. And he had no hair.
What does the horrors mean? I thought he had the horrors.
It probably means like when you're shooken up, but I don't know. That was a total guess.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was figuring.
What is the horrors?
Like you're afraid of something that happened that could have been paranormal?
What does the horrors mean?
Well, she mentioned drinking.
The Sunday scaries?
When you have it in an Australian kitchen with 7-foot-high windows.
It mentioned that he'd been drinking. The horrors be like a drinking-related thing?
Oh, maybe.
Like there's a certain kind of alcohol in Australia that gets you so messed up you like hallucinate monsters?
Or just like if you drink regularly and you...
Why would you call it the horrors, though?
Withdrawal.
Maybe like delirium tremens?
That's kind of what I was thinking. Like, because you can hallucinate if you're...
Well, you said he was sober.
At the time of the incident.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what the horrors is.
In Australian slang, the horrors refers to intense anxiety and nervous depression, often associated with withdrawal symptoms from alcohol or drugs. Oh, okay, so we're kind of right.
See?
It describes a state of extreme psychological distress characterized by feelings of dread, panic, and severe agitation. This term captures unsettling and terrifying nature of the experience and can occur when you have 7-foot-high windows in your kitchen. So that's it.
And saucer-headed beings are looking in.
Particularly that. Yeah, that was a strange story. It sounds like a different kind of entity, but the same kind of phenomena going on in the outback.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
The horrors couldn't explain you being basically frozen and then picked up through the air and put through a tiny window, you know?
Yeah. That's the first I kind of heard of like a physical, a very violent abduction. You know what I mean? Like, you usually get the tractor beam that kind of zaps you out. Like, you pass through walls. I've heard accounts like that. This is physically, it just sounds like a different technology, a different kind of entity.
Well, yeah. And if you want to take it that way, if you want to take the story literally and this, you want to say this occurred for sure.
I do.
Well, think about how the being is a very unique description. Same thing with, if you could say the technology could be different. Maybe it's a, it's not your usual ET out there in the outback in this experience.
Yeah. It's
a different breed,
different kind of fella coming through looking for a midnight snack.
I don't want these in my backyard.
No. Chris, what is the next account? Does that connect at all? Because I know there's another account from 1970 from Kiama.
It connects in the way that it has unique qualities like the other story. Different sorts of, does it allude to different kinds of technology? This one's really cool.
Oh yeah, this is very different.
And this gets into, it's an incredibly strange account, but it gets into the strange behavior of the light beam itself.
Yeah.
And how the light moves. You've heard stories like this before where light does not act naturally, where it fills up a room somehow when it's not, when it's coming through a window. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I think we had a story about people camping in a van. And remember that? It was, I forget what state park that was.
Oh, yeah.
But in their experience, the light, it seemed like it was brighter than daylight. And it filled, somehow was able to fill every nook and cranny of the van. You're going to hear something very similar in this account. So I think that's what makes this story interesting.
Like a milky light. And remember what happened with Ben and the Beckoners?
Oh, yeah.
You know, they beckoned him into the craft and he saw those two kids in cages.
Was that the hot dog craft? The hot dog bun? Hot dog roll?
Yeah, with the poor little girls in the cages. Keep that in mind because this might be another collector. And that's all I'll say.
The author calls him Graham. It's a pseudonym. And for all you stateside people out there, when they say caravan in this, it's not like an old wagon. It's just what they refer to a van as a caravan. You know, much like in the UK.
Oh, well, that's where van comes from.
Actually, in the Australian context, a caravan is any vehicle that is designed to live in and is towable, like an Airstream or small mobile home.
So this happened in 1970 in Kiama, New South Wales. I was awoken by a light coming into the room. Suddenly I saw a light beam, white in color, with a blue fluorescent tinge evaporating from it. Because of the luminescence of the light, I was able to make out the shape of a flying craft from which the beam projected at an angle to the ground of about 75 degrees. The beam was about 30 feet long and about 2 feet 6 inches in diameter. I looked out the window and saw it hit a caravan. Upon impact, the light behaved like water, pouring over the caravan, over its roof, over its walls, over every nook and cranny of the van. It reached the beach and illuminated an area of sand about 40 feet at its widest. Inside the lighted area were two men standing motionless, looking up at the craft. A young woman jumped up from a small fire and ran to stand with the two men. A second young woman was running backwards, trying to brush the light off her arms and body. The light suddenly went out. And I looked for the people. Has it taken the people? I thought. So at this point in the story, Graham blacks out. And when he wakes up, this is what he experiences. I looked outside the window, only feet away. The craft hovered over the street in front of the house. It maneuvered very close to the window. The metallic material it was made of appeared as though it was unpolished zinc alloy. I looked at a window shape about 6 feet wide and 2 feet 6 inches high. A man walked into the room of the craft and stood in front of the window. As he walked in, he was looking at a flat object he was holding in his hands, like a clipboard, but thicker. Another man then entered the room, looking at the other man and what he was doing. They had bright silver one-piece suits, like thin wetsuits, with no badges or markings. The last one to enter the room smiled at the other. Then they both smiled directly at me. I had physical fright. My hair stood on end, literally. And I knew what it meant to be really scared. I dropped to the floor and said, "Everybody keep down! Stay out of the light!" Suddenly, great noise and severe vibration of the house took place. The laundry light went dim. The fridge began jumping about, and there was a great noise above the roof. It was like the craft overhead sucked the electricity out of the house. Then it took off. Strange.
Very creepy. A craft sitting outside your window. You can see into the windows.
That's the part I like about the story. He just sees it kind of come down the neighborhood street and just goes, whoop. And then it's at the window and they're monitoring him with some sort of clipboardy thing. Definitely a little eerie.
That and the, obviously the way that the light behaved. And then the woman who jumped up from the small fire and ran to stand with the two men from the craft.
Yeah, that was my favorite part because it's such an interesting fact in the story that she's trying to wipe the light off of her skin.
Oh, the other woman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Running backwards, trying to wipe the light off. What a weird. And it's so bizarre too, that this would be hard to, I think in the future, look back on and not think, would I dream that?
Yeah.
Like the way everything operated was so strange.
Oh yeah.
And according to Bill Chalker, the guy who investigated this said that the anonymous fella who this occurred to has later decided, where he quote, prefers to think of it as a dream. But according to the original investigator, he's convinced that this was an actual near abduction.
That'd definitely be easier to just think of it as a dream.
Yeah. Maybe it was. I hope for his sake.
Yeah.
But it does seem to match a lot of these other cases, although with those unique attributes, I'd say. What is really interesting, I think, this is something that Bill Chalker writes about in his book, is that if you're looking for a connection with the indigenous aborigines of Australia, there's a connection with the shamans, which is really interesting.
How so?
There's a parallel he discovered between aboriginal shamanism and UFO abduction. Apparently, accounts of ritualistic initiation are super similar to modern-day UFO contactee and abduction lore. Australian shamans, or clever men, or men of high degree, in their history and their beliefs, they describe, quote, celestial ascents to meet, quote, the sky gods, and have, quote, the experience of death and rising again.
That's part of their ceremony, right? To become a...
Yes, the initiation ceremony to become a shaman. And it seems like the death and rise again, a lot of abduction scenarios when you're put under for some sort of procedure.
Yeah.
And then you're brought back after having something put inside of you.
Right.
There's an exchange with the sky gods. There's an exchange of something from them that they put inside your body, and then they bring you back afterwards. And then it gives you, in this case with the shamans, it gives you essentially the ability to be a medicine man.
Yeah. It's in the ceremony. It's called like the dissected man ceremony or something, but that's literally kind of the translation. But the sky god puts stones inside of him and then like stitches him back up, and so now he's this, I forget the term, but he's got a specific kind of name. He's not a wise man, but something like that after that experience.
I think it's medicine man.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
At least that's the translation here. But yeah, I found that really interesting. I found the parallels. There was a specific account where an aborigine named Kirkuchi was taken by two spirits. They cut him right down the middle, put the sacred stones in his body, and then when they restored him to life, told him that he was now a medicine man, showed him how to extract bones and other forms of evil magic. And then they took him away into the sky and brought him down to earth, close to his own camp, where he heard the natives mourning for him, thinking he was dead. And then after that, he remained in a daze for a while. But after recovering, the natives knew he'd been made a medicine man.
Huh.
But there's plenty of parallels where they refer to it as climbing at night by means of a rope invisible to ordinary mortals up to the sky where he can hold converse with the star people. An invisible rope. So there's all kinds of interesting accounts of this idea of being pulled up to the sky, climbing into the sky.
Yeah, what is that? Because what does that look like? An invisible rope, someone being basically levitated up into the air.
Yeah.
Like, which is described in so many of these accounts.
So is there a certain, you know, just like we have in America, the Hopi that had contact with the ancient ant people from underground that helped them survive the Great Cataclysm. We have the star people of different tribes where it seems like there's a connection.
Yeah.
Whereas like, you know, other poor Australian folk just getting sucked out of houses aren't getting turned into medicine men, sadly.
Yeah.
But it's almost like certain chosen people, or maybe because of an ancient connection, maybe even genetic connection, they're gifted this ability.
Maybe it's all point of view. It's all how you look at your experience.
That's true. But there does seem to be more like transparency and understanding of what's happening with the medicine men.
Mm-hmm.
If any of it's real. Anyways, moving along. So you guys may have heard of this account. Maybe not. This is the Boyanai incident.
Oh, yeah.
This occurred way back in 1959, June 26th. And it stands out among a lot of cases, specifically in Australia.
This isn't actually in Australia, though, right? It's nearby.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's Papua New Guinea, which is just an island pooped off the coast of Australia.
Just a crocodile skitter away.
But yes, Papua New Guinea, Boyanai. And our main figure in the story is Father William B. Gill, who was a missionary, I believe, who operated a church out there. And what makes this unique is that he, and not only he, but 38 local residents all witnessed the same craft in the sky seemingly interacting with them, watching them for not 20 minutes, not a couple hours, for 3 days.
What?
In the sky. Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, it would come and go, but it was regularly hanging out.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, let's hear it in his own words.
Let's do it. This is
we'll have this documentary linked.
Yeah. This is a clip from an old TV program, and he's older now. Obviously, the clip, I think, is filmed in the 80s, maybe 70s, late 70s, early 80s. But it did occur in 1959, so he's recalling it.
One of the most credible witnesses we interviewed was an Australian minister, the Reverend William Gill, posted before the time of his sighting to the Anglican mission in Boinai, Papua New Guinea. One night at 7:45, as he stood with 38 other people at the edge of the mission playing field, every one of them saw the same thing.
Can you imagine what it's like to look up in the sky and see a totally foreign-looking object? They're just hovering, not very far high up, maybe 200 or 300 feet up in the air, and glowing, and two bipods jutting out from behind it, from underneath it, and sparkling all around, and some figures up there. This solid-looking object, and figures walking about on top, and not the slightest noise whatsoever. And so we waved. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get this object down onto the playing field? And as we waved, wondering whether we'd get some recognition and whether perhaps they would understand what we wanted, they waved back. So I asked a boy to go quickly down, bring me a torch, bring me a pencil, bring me paper, and return as quickly as he can so that I can get any other events that occur, minute-by-minute movements, so that at least we'd be able to talk about it the next day. And this he did, very, very quickly. He brought it back, and he brought the torch and put the torch on and shone it to the craft. And as he did so, he waved moved the torch this way. And we were dumbfounded when we looked at the craft, and the craft was as though it was responding to the torch. It began to do this too, you know, like a disc-shaped object just moving the same way, responding to the movement of the torch. Next day, just prior to the evening service, about 7 o'clock, the thing was there again. It had arrived about an hour earlier, and we all decided to have the normal evensong that we do have on those nights, because well, the thing was out there outside the church anyway, and we felt it wouldn't go away during the service, and it didn't. When we came out, there it was, still up in the sky. And so for another hour or two we watched, and then suddenly it did go, and there was this amazingly incredible speed that the whole craft disappeared to nothing across the bay in a matter of a second or so. Well, now, what are we to think of this kind of phenomenon, people claiming to see things such as I did? There were 38 of us, and we all believe that we saw it, but of course we don't expect other people to believe us if they don't want to.
I believe you.
Well, that's a good expectation to have.
Interesting.
Yeah, you gotta hold your expectations carefully.
It sounds like such like a cool dream you have, where like something miraculous like that happens, and especially when there's not a darkness to it, and it happens over a 3 day period, where it's like, am I living in a dream right now?
That would be life changing, but definitely a more positive experience, or at least neutral.
Yeah.
But he's not alone. You know, some people would believe him because I don't know if you guys remember on the main episode, I found, and I meant to have these in the same episode originally, but there was corroborative reports. 1978, which is, you know, 20, 30 years later. Tell me if this sounds familiar. A young couple flashed their torch or flashlight at the night sky, and a craft descended 50 miles away. So responding to the flashlight, it was also saucer-shaped. It also had entities that they waved to who waved back.
Yeah.
And that was in Warkworth. Actually, I think it might have been New Zealand, but, you know, right in the same general vicinity. And then the other description that I had that I found interesting connected to another story that we used on the main feed, which is corroborative, which took place in 1975 in Brookby, which I think is also New Zealand, but where a couple were fishing and the object that they saw in the sky was, again, this will sound familiar, a dome with legs. The little bipod or, you know, four legs, where it was.
The classic sci-fi tripod.
Yeah.
And they also saw shadowy figures moving around inside. And then it shot off. I mean, you know, these attributes that are so similar.
Yeah.
It's so strange.
There's something in this area. Makes you want to go out to... It sounds exciting to do, but also freaky. You know, not that if you go out with a flashlight in a remote area, you're going to get a,
signal
a visitation. But I'm going to go to like Enchanted Rock with some flashlights and like a night vision camera.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That would be fun. When you guys come back, we should definitely go out there.
Speaking of Enchanted Rock.
Isn't that where you ran into Greer?
Yeah.
Stephen Greer? He was out there with like a group, right?
Yes.
Dr. Stephen Greer.
Yes. He said they saw something out there too. They was showing me pictures.
Well, he's a summoner. Maybe we can get some summoning advice.
Yeah. Can't he summon?
Yeah.
Allegedly?
That's part of his shtick.
Yeah. Does he use a flashlight?
He uses his heart.
I think it's all like intent.
Yeah. Okay. I know that in the desert, what's the...
Contact in the Desert?
The Joshua Tree, Contact in the Desert, they go out with like night vision cameras and infrared, that kind of stuff, and watch the sky and try to communicate.
Yeah, I do want to do that. We do have that night vision camera. I do want to do that because you'd see some crazy stuff.
We should camp.
That'd be cool.
Enchanted Rock.
Oh, dude,
That'd be fun.
Just wake up and I'm gone and you never see me again.
It's just taken away by reptilians, pulling them into the sand.
No, I don't want the reptilians. I want like the beautiful, you know... Blonde, tall.
Oh, you want the Nordics.
Yeah, the Nordics.
Do they have any brunette Nordics? That'd be cool.
Specific.
With bangs.
They're looking for Chris. We have a specific Nordic woman we'd like you to breed with, Chris.
Just plimbo and splup splark in disguise.
That would be fun, though. We should definitely do something like that sometime.
Yeah.
And see what happens. Life's short. Get abducted. Not really. His life might be shorter.
Anyways, that report did go on to make its way to the RAF, Royal Air Force Arms of Air Force.
Yeah, RAF. It's the Britain's Air Force.
Yeah. It was initially, they were pretty skeptical. Everyone was pretty skeptical, but the reports were so consistent. And actually, there was a dump of these reports. I actually read through all the files where the militaries and government agencies from Britain, Australia, the US and NASA were all communicating about this event and local UFO investigation groups that were around at the time.
I was going to say, if it's 3 days, you'd think they would get wind of it.
Yeah. So there were local groups, it's like the Victorian UFO investigative group, but they were on the ground investigating this and they were writing to like the Air Force and different groups who might know about what might be in the sky. And it's interesting reading it because you can hear like kind of the annoyance of the government groups that are like, they'd write this like long kind of letter, like, as a group investigating on the ground with all this experience, we're looking to you for help and leadership in this time of need. And I hope we can become great friends and very trying to like get on the good side of the military and government. And then they're right back like, at this time, we don't have any information.
Yeah, it was funny because you said you were reading like memos between different government agencies and they were kind of like, these guys.
Yeah, then the military, whoever they wrote to initially, they would write a letter to their higher ups or another military group and be like, I can't get this guy off my back. And now they're talking about it and whatever government body in the press, we can't really ignore them anymore. So you can read in the timeline what the agencies are saying to themselves about the quote public.
Right. It's interesting for sure.
And how they're kind of annoyed by it. And then eventually they do end up giving some credence to it or at least showing some interest. And NASA actually volunteers to provide some information. So
that's unusual.
But it is just interesting to see that kind of insight of like how the government was working at the time. And I'm sure it's not too different today as far as, you know, how open they are with the public.
Interesting. I would have liked to have been there.
Me too. Fascinating story. Let's go find our own.
Enchanted Rock, here we come.
Enchanted Rock, let's do it.
I'll bring the flashlights.
That would be awesome.
For those that don't know, it is about 2 hours west of Austin.
Is it that far?
Maybe.
I don't remember being that far.
It was. Maybe it's only an hour.
It's like a half an hour, I thought.
No, it's definitely farther than that.
Really? Yeah, I mean, sure, you're right. I don't remember being that far.
Remember Fredericksburg, that old Texas town that's out right before you get out there?
Oh, okay, yeah.
Very like Texas.
Yeah.
Typical Texas you think of.
Like those little towns between Houston and Austin.
Very ranchy.
Yeah.
You know, it's barbecue and just flat, deserty kind of looking place.
Is it highly populated?
But it's very touristy.
Like Gideon.
It's very cool. God, it makes me want to go out there like right now.
It's nice. You can. You're close.
I know, but it's sad to go by myself.
I know the feeling.
I remember one time I took Jake, I think it was with Dad, actually. That was when we saw
Stephen Greer.
And Stephen Greer loved Jake, but Jake did not love Stephen Greer.
Does everyone know who Stephen Greer is? Do we need to inform?
I feel like anyone that's in the paranormal would know, or UFO stuff.
As long as they're into UFO stuff.
He ran the Disclosure Project, allegedly briefed a lot of presidents on the UFO phenomenon.
Pretty famous guy in the UFO world, if not one of the most famous.
Just Googler him. He's controversial too. I mean, as far as whether you believe, you know.
He was a medical doctor before.
Yeah. I think was an ER doctor or something.
Yeah, ER doctor.
And then he was like, I'm going to get buff and start hunting aliens.
Some of them.
Very strange. The whole thing is very strange. I don't discount him. Like, I don't think that he's lying. It's just he's a quirky guy.
Oh, definitely. A bit of a, eccentric fellow. Seems like a nice guy. I mean, I get a good feeling from him.
Yeah, I don't have any bad feelings about him. I just think he's got a quirky personality.
Yeah, he doesn't come off as a grifter. I've heard people make the claims like, well, because he charges people to go with him to go to these things. Well, you got to make a living.
He was an ER doctor. He could have just, I'm going to be an alien surveyor or whatever. Instead of being an ER doctor.
He
obviously cares about it. He did the Disclosure Project, literally went to Congress.
Yeah. What was it? 200 military and corporate witnesses that come out. Was that the day before 9/11?
No, we looked this up. It wasn't the day before. I think a couple weeks before or something.
While the Disclosure Project's press conference heard in depth reports from only 20 high-level witnesses with visual and analytical evidence, Dr. Greer claimed to have gathered further testimony from over 400 military, intelligence, and government witnesses who had first-hand experiences with UFO sightings or alien evidence. And while it was held on May 9, 2001, and received significant attention at the time, it was later overshadowed by the events of September 11, 2001. The terrorist attacks on September 11th dominated global media coverage and public attention, effectively burying many other stories, including those related to the Disclosure Project.
Still, that's pretty close.
Yeah, got buried.
But anyways.
And the aliens blew up the towers.
I'm gonna finish my story.
Sorry.
Which has no relevance at all. This is much more interesting. I was in Fredericksburg with Dad and Jake. And now this story sounds dumb.
There better be aliens in this story.
Well, you already said you saw Stephen Greer, so that's relevant.
Yeah, I'm not even finishing this story. It's so irrelevant.
No, I want to hear the end of it. Do you have a nice pie, piece of pie or something?
I had pie with Stephen Greer.
I was sitting out in the patio with Jake and he tried to eat someone.
Oh, really?
Stephen Greer?
No, my dog.
Stephen Greer tried to eat someone.
He's serious. He's a reptilian.
I knew there was something off about that guy.
So Jake tried to basically attack somebody and eat him up?
Yeah, he did try to attack several people.
Oh, man. Was that when you're like, okay, I can't do this anymore. I can't bring him out places?
Yeah.
Well, what happened?
They just walked by him.
But then where did Stephen Greer come in?
Oh, no, Stephen Greer was at
Enchanted Rock.
We were at Fredericksburg, or we were at Enchanted Rock, walking in the parking lot or something.
That'd be so weird.
Anyways, none of that is really that relevant, but I do want to go to Enchanted Rock with you guys and we should maybe film some stuff.
That'd be fun. Definitely, man.
It's such a magical, it reminds me of New Mexico, that kind of weird, mysterious, enchanted kind of place.
Yeah.
And obviously if Stephen Greer's hunting aliens there, then UFOs there, there's got to be something going on out there.
Believe whole investigation.
And I freaking saw a UFO in Austin. That's what started it all for me.
That's right, yeah.
So many years ago.
It's weird. Weird to think about.
Should you meet up in Austin sometime? We're down. That'd be fun.
Yeah, if you're from Austin, let us know. It would be fun to have, if there's enough people out here, it'd be cool to...
We've got a good amount in Texas, I know.
A gathering.
Yeah. We did have a couple people write in from all over when we were doing the call out for Camp Creepley stories. We had several people saying it'd be so much fun to do a meetup. And I chimed in saying what I said in the show, I'd love to one day do at a campground or something. There were several people that I would fly in for something like that.
Yeah. It'd be fun to do it to give people enough advance notice and go to a really cool place.
Yeah.
A place worth going to.
Right. A Walmart parking lot.
Yes, exactly. In Michigan.
In Michigan. I like Michigan.
No, do a legitimate meetup where it's we can stay somewhere.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I say we rent out Camp Wainoa.
That would be awesome.
We all get cabins.
No, let's go somewhere cool.
What? Are you talking about a camp?
I don't know yet. I'm just thinking out loud right now.
I don't think John cares about a camp.
Oh, you're not talking about the Camp Creepley later. You're just talking about a meetup in general.
Well, if we're doing Camp Creepley, I mean, maybe Colorado or something.
That'd be cool.
You know, something fun.
That'd be a bit far for us, but it would be cool.
Well, if we're all going to... Well, you guys don't like flying. That's the problem.
It could be in the middle, like Tennessee or North Carolina.
If you
or...
flew, it would be easier.
Yes, but my eyeball will explode.
I don't believe that. I think that's, a fallacy.
That's what the doctor told me.
Can't go deep sea diving?
He said if you go into the sky, your eye will explode.
He did not say that.
He told me I can't be an astronaut. That was the first thing he said.
Well, I don't think you're in danger of that. You're not on the track.
I'm not an astronaut because he warned me. I was on my way. I was studying.
Anyway, we'll figure it out.
Anyways, let's move along.
Well, I think it'd be appropriate to end this episode with a classic Dogman account. Well, maybe Dogman, right? Isn't that the conjecture?
It's a Dingo Man, I'd argue.
Oh, okay. Well, that is appropriate.
Yes. I mean, that's what I'm calling it because it's Australia. Why not call it a Dingo Man? This comes from 1906 in Emmaville, New South Wales. And at the time, the papers were referring to it as the Yahoo, named after the incredible search engine.
This sounds familiar. I feel like I might know this account. What year was this?
1906.
I was going to say, this sounds like the Yahoo. That sounds like a 1906 name of a monster that you
read
about.
Yeah, that term's been used, you know, worldwide around that time. All right, here we go.
Case 120, June 1906. The Yahoo again. A correspondent of the Glen Innes Guardian says that Mr. E.J. Clifford has had this exciting experience about 5 miles north of the Gulf. He was crawling through dense scrub when a wild animal rose up in front of him and, as if frightened, paused for a moment. Clifford, who had a .32 Winchester, fired as speedily as possible. The animal, which he says appeared to be 8 feet high and 3 feet broad, black in color, and covered with hair of great length, gave several unearthly yells and made off. Clifford fired 2 more shots at it as it fled over a flat. Following it for about 1/4 mile, he saw blood and huge footprints where the animal crossed a creek in the sand. The head of the animal seemed to be shaped like that of a dog. It at first stood upright like a human being and ran on 2 legs at a great pace. It was some 42 yards away from Clifford when first seen. The time was about midday, and Clifford saw it clearly. A rifle party of about 30 has left the gulf in search of the creature. Clifford is said to have shown some of the miners the blood and tracks on the sand.
There you go, guys. Dogman in Australia.
Dogman strikes again.
It's funny because, I mean, I've heard the explanation. People have made the point that, like, maybe dogmen that people are seeing in the States are, like, loosed kangaroo. You heard this
idea? That's actually, in some cases, I do think that's
kind of interesting because this is Australia. Obviously, there's a lot of roos over there. So could that account for some of these cases? Obviously, 8 feet tall, you know, not quite.
Yeah. Roos can get tall, but I don't know.
But roos do go on all fours occasionally and then obviously stand.
Yeah. No, that's a good point, Chris. This is Australia, after all. Kangaroos are terrifying.
Did you guys see this video cam, like the cam footage, like a hunting camera, what it's called?
Trail cam?
Trail cam, yes. Usually those aren't very good. I feel like when there's like, oh, look at this thing that's caught on the trail cam. But I saw one recently that was pretty impressive. Thinker Thunker broke it down, but it basically was like 3 dogmen. Did you see that?
Oh, yeah. That was a while ago. Oh, yeah. Probably like a month ago.
Going up and down. And yeah, pretty.
We'll have to do that on the next Cozy Belief Hole Hangout in the Hole live stream.
Yeah, pretty convincing the way that they moved around. Like it would be hard to argue that they were human.
Yeah.
But they were certainly not normal animals. They looked.
Yeah, we got to make a note to pull that clip for the next live stream.
Yeah, I'll do that for sure. But yeah, and by the way, we will be doing live streams eventually. People keep asking about it, but you know, over the break, we're going to try to work on the video stuff and get that figured out.
Yeah, camera situation. Fix Chris's glitchy internet.
Yes.
Fun times in the future, guys. So thanks for being here. Thanks for hanging out in the hole.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it means the world to us.
We love you.
We love you so hard.
So deep and hard.
Okay.
In the hole.
Sound good.
Okay.
All right, guys, we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Be awesome. Stay awesome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.